This is Queen Elizabeth, speaking to you from the 16th century. Nothing displeases me more than history myths. And you know what I do when I get displeased? Get an axe and chop off some heads? No! I summon Professor Buzzkill, who explains everything. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again. Join me in listening to a new episode.
In 1876, Buzzkillers, an elderly man decided to write his memoirs. As we'll see during the show, he and his wife were very important in 19th century America. They helped a great many people achieve freedom, but very few people nowadays have heard of them. As he was writing his autobiography, this old man wanted to stress the centrality and strength of one of his earliest experiences and the impact it had on how he chose to live his life. You see, Levi Coffin became an opponent of slavery and an abolitionist at the age of 7 when he saw a slave working on a chain gang. Young Levi asked him why he was being held in chains, and the slave replied that the chains were there to prevent him from escaping and returning to his wife and family. The impact of this encounter was very strong, and it touched Levi very deeply. The recently released movie about Harriet Tubman has prompted a lot of discussion about the history of the Underground Railroad. And several Buzzkillers have emailed me asking specific questions about things they've seen in the movie or things they've heard about the Underground Railroad in school. Invariably, people seem to know only a little bit about it and seem only to have heard about Harriet Tubman. The history of the Underground Railroad is much longer, much fuller, much richer, and much more complex and compelling than what's depicted in the movie Harriet. This is a special show on two genuine heroes from the early history of the Underground Railroad, Levi and Catherine Coffin. It's kind of a combined Man Crush Monday and Woman Crush Wednesday show, and we're putting out here for all Buzzkillers, not just our Patreon members. Having said that, I want to remind you that generally, Man Crush Mondays and Woman Crush Wednesdays are only available to our Patreon members, so please go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and click the Support the Show button. Despite being called the parents of the Underground Railroad, Levi and Catherine Coffin are almost completely forgotten. Their Indiana home is now the Coffin House, a National Historic Landmark in Fountain City, Indiana, but no one's made a major motion picture about them, though they certainly deserve one. Underground Railroad historians and other experts from that field estimate that Levi and Catherine Coffin helped rescue and convey between 3,000 and 3,300 escaped slaves to freedom via the Underground Railroad. Now, Buzzkillers, you know the one thing I really hate is what I call scoreboard history. Who did the most in terms of numbers and all that stuff? Everyone who worked on the Underground Railroad was obviously committed, selfless, and heroic. So I don't want to say that Levi and Catherine Coffin were more important than Harriet Tubman, who is estimated to have saved and transported around 150 slaves, but I do want to say that they should receive a great deal more attention and celebration. So let's go back to their early lives. Levi and Catherine Coffin were both born in North Carolina, Levi in 1798 and Catherine in 1803. Levi grew up in a non-slave-owning Quaker family in Guilford County, and it's fairly clear that his parents were strong abolitionists. Now, despite living in a slave state, like other Quakers in the area, Levi's parents hid escaping slaves on the family farm and helped them get out of North Carolina as early as 1918. This, as you might imagine, was a very dangerous thing to do. The Fugitive Slave Law of 1793 made it illegal, and North Carolina passed black laws in the early 1800s to crack down on abolitionists. Quakers were well known to help escaping slaves, and local authorities became increasingly vigilant in harassing them. The Coffin family, including young Levi, did a number of things for North Carolina slaves in the 1810s and early 1820s. Hiding some runaways in their farmhouse and in the outbuildings on their farm, founding and running a Sunday school for slaves, making and repairing slave clothing, and providing food in times of scarcity. But it soon became obvious that North Carolina was too dangerous for Quaker abolitionists and early Underground Railroad workers. Along with fellow Quaker Benjamin White, Levi Coffin, the young man in his early 20s, traveled to the Indiana Territory in 1822 and met fellow Quakers there. Now, Levi was impressed with Indiana and soon returned to the Quaker community in Guilford, North Carolina, to spread the word about the possibilities for slave abolition in the territories and the possibilities for helping slaves escape to what was then the West, that is Indiana. Now, while home in North Carolina, Levi married Catherine White, a longtime family friend. After the birth of their first child in 1825, Levi and Catherine moved with more or less the whole extended Coffin family to Newport, Indiana, which is now called Fountain City, and is on the Ohio border. The Coffins started farming in Indiana and eventually opened a dry goods store in the town of Newport in probably 1827. What later became known as the Underground Railroad was already running in America, which I'll explain in a later episode. And as you might imagine, it went right through the center of the country, including the Western territories, which meant Indiana and Ohio. The Coffins were very successful in running the dry goods store, and rather than stockpile lots of cash and investing it, they decided to spend their profits on helping runaway slaves move through Indiana to safer places further north. Here's how they made it work. Newport, Indiana was already home to a largest number of free blacks, people who were either born free or had had their freedom granted to them before they moved to Indiana. That community started harboring and protecting escaped slaves in the early 1820s. The problem was that fugitive slave catchers knew about this and were sometimes able to capture runaway slaves hiding on these free black farms or in these free black homes. The places were just too obvious. And since the fugitive slave law was a national law, Northerners were required to comply with it no matter what their own personal views on slavery were. After establishing themselves in Newport, the Coffins contacted these free black groups and offered to hide some runaways in their own home. Since Levi was becoming a businessman, prominent-ish businessman in the Newport community, he was able to, you know, establish ordinary commercial connections with townspeople and farmers, and his, if you will, networking didn't seem out of place or too obvious to slave catchers or their lookouts. Therefore, the Coffin House quickly became a better place to take in runaways and to eventually convey them to the next stop on the railroad, because there were a lot of people in and around the Coffins all the time. This is a crucial aspect of the early Underground Railroad that should be better known and understood by Americans. Many of us have the impression that escaping slaves were brought all the way north by conductors on the Underground Railroad, who accompanied them the whole way. This was very rare. Sometimes it happened, and it was more common in Harriet Tubman's day, that is, you know, the late 1850s, but it was definitely the exception and not the rule. Here's what usually happened. Escaping slaves would run north and toward places they had heard were safer, hoping they'd find an Underground Railroad station, I'm putting station in quotation marks, you know, that is a safe house or a safe farm run by people sympathetic to runaway slaves and willing to hide them. And then when it was safe to continue their flight, they would move to the next safe house and eventually to Canada or someplace so far north that fugitive slave catchers wouldn't find them or wouldn't bother to find them. It's important to remember, however, that a lot of the words I'm using, such as Underground Railroad and station and safe house, weren't used in the early days of this system, and I'm putting system in quotation marks too. And the organization that grew up around southern Ohio and Indiana didn't really have a name until the mid-1830s. Levi Coffin called it the Mysterious Road in the beginning of the Coffin family involvement in late 1826 or early 1827. And geography was crucial here. Three major important escape routes pass through the Coffin home, pass through the hometown of Newport. And even in the very beginning, nearly 100 slaves went through their care every year. Again, the key was that the coffin home, like other stops on the mysterious road, were places for slaves to stop, rest, get fed consistently, and get prepared to move to the next stop. The coffins built up a network of connections with other stops further north to help, and they led by example. It was no secret that there was an escape route through town, but many people in Newport, especially Quakers who were opposed to slavery and the Fugitive Slave Law, were afraid to help the coffins because, initially anyway, because of the dangers, both, you know, legal and physical. But since the coffins were able to hide slaves and move them further on their way over a few years without being harmed themselves, some of the neighbors realized it was safe and began to help. But that was far from the universal reaction in Newport. A good number of residents had more or less ignored the coffin slave harboring and transport, but didn't agree with it. In fact, as the coffin effort became more successful and some other Newport people joined in, there was a brief backlash. The Newport people who were opposed to this increasing activity were either anti-Underground Railroad, as it was now being known by the early 1830s, because of their racist attitudes towards African Americans, or because they were afraid of the legal ramifications of violating the Fugitive Slave Law. Some Newport residents started to refuse to patronize the coffin's dry goods store in the early 1830s, and their business started to suffer. But then there was a backlash against the backlash. Newport's population was growing in the 1820s and 1830s, and a great number of the newcomers were deeply religious, strongly Quaker, strongly anti-slavery. And they even gravitated towards Newport and the Coffin's dry goods store specifically because of its centrality to the Underground Railroad. These people made special efforts to support the store and to alleviate some of the slave harboring burden borne by the Coffins. Levi Coffin's finances rebounded, and he and Catherine were able to diversify their investments, including land ownership, a paint shop, hog butchering, flaxseed mill, and investing in two largest banks in Indiana. Now, when we get back from this sponsorship break, we'll learn how the Coffins were able to invest more deeply in the Underground Railroad and become, essentially, among the most important of the railroad's leaders. And we'll learn why Levi Coffin was often referred to as the father of the Underground Railroad. Back in a sec. Buzzkillers, you know how totally stoked I am that we are sponsored by the Great Courses Plus. And I'm stoked because, as they say, knowledge is power. And thanks to the Great Courses Plus, we get to tap into this power with just one click. With their streaming service, you can unlock unlimited access to objective, reliable, fascinating information on virtually any subject. You'll be learning from the brightest minds around the world, benefiting from their years of experience and unique insights to help formulate your own knowledge and perspective, so you can transform from being a student into being a master. With over 40,000 five-star reviews on the Great Courses Plus, you're guaranteed to find compelling content. I recommend, especially for this episode that we're doing, the course, The American Civil War, presented by Professor Gary Gallagher from the University of Virginia. It's great. The sections go from, obviously, the prelude to secession in the 1850s, all the way through this war itself, and to the end of the war. And I particularly like the final two episodes, Closing Scenes and Reckonings, and Remembering the War. Now remember, in order to tap into this knowledge, join me and thousands of other listeners by signing up for the Great Courses Plus. For a limited time, you buzzkillers will get unlimited access completely free for an entire month. So don't wait. Sign up today. Simply use my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Buzzkillers, this is free. This isn't free shipping or extra shaving cream or extra this or extra that. It's free, right? That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Do it now, buzzkillers. Back to the show. Okay, by the late 1830s, Levi Coffin was in his late 40s and Catherine was in her mid-30s. They had each been helping escapees since their late teens. They'd put their own safety, their own property, their own livelihoods at risk. They were part of a larger group of activists doing the same things and risking the same things. They had lived through business ups and downs and had diversified and solidified their financial base, to use an anachronistic term. It would certainly have been understandable if they decided to keep themselves secure and stop, frankly, this risky humanitarianism. Well, you know where I'm going with this, buzzkillers. The Levites didn't keep themselves secure. They doubled down, to use another 20th/20th century term, on the Underground Railroad. They built a new house in Newport, larger, made of brick, and designed with the Underground Railroad in mind. They built hiding places for slaves, including a space in the maids' quarters for 14 people. And they built other passageways to make their railroad work both easier and more secret. Now, this was expensive and difficult. But it was necessary because slave catchers and fugitive slave hunters were crafty in trying to figure out how to get into what they suspected were safe houses. So Levi and Catherine designed their new house to buy time. What I mean is they needed time, sometimes very short amounts of time, when confronted by slave catchers. Levi was especially brave in demanding that slave catchers show the proper legal documentation at the door. Required documentation included search warrants and slave ownership papers, according to the fugitive slave law. Slave catchers didn't always have these things with them, and they had to go to local courts to get search warrants. And this was usually too difficult or too time-consuming, and the new coffin house was never searched before any of the slaves they were hiding were smuggled out and sent to the next Underground Railroad station. You see, most slave catchers suspected the coffins of harboring runaway slaves, and the larger community around Newport, India, probably knew of their Underground Railroad work. But the coffins made sure to disguise a great deal of their work in lots of ways. Again, Levi Coffin's business concerns required him to meet a lot of people, and having a dry goods store meant that shipments of products were always arriving, and there were delivery men, and there were lots of customers going in and out of the store, so there was a lot of traffic in the coffins' lives. It was easy-ish to hide fellow Underground Railroad workers in and among regular customers, and it was easy, again, ish, to communicate with fellow Underground Railroad workers in this way. They mixed in with the other people in the day-to-day running of the coffins' lives and businesses. Catherine Coffin took charge of the more domestic needs of fugitive slaves. Again, she probably did this to avoid suspicion. She concentrated on the traditional gender roles of the time and was far less likely, therefore, to raise suspicion than if she had tried other types of Underground Railroad work. For instance, she organized a sewing circle among her friends, and they met regularly at the coffin house. Now, this was a common thing for women in their position to do and wouldn't on its own come to the attention of slave catchers or those opposed to the Underground Railroad. But these sewing circles were far more than just embroidery and tea. The women worked on clothes for runaway slaves, not only mending travel clothes, but creating whole new outfits and sometimes disguises for fugitive slaves to wear. And Catherine was also more or less in charge of organizing regular meals and preparing traveling food for escaped slaves. Again, the fact that the coffins owned a retail business and the fact that they had a large family meant that relatively large amounts of food passed through their shop and their house, and it wasn't suspicious in and of itself. But she also made sure that her fellow Underground Railroad workers contributed to the food stores and cooked many of the meals so that the work was dispersed throughout the underground community. So it was a complex and continuing effort that required the participation of the whole adult coffin family and that of many like-minded people in and around Newport. But here we come to one of the major problems faced by Underground Railroad activists and workers. The project did not have universal support among abolitionists and even religious groups like the Coffin's Own Quakers. By the late 1830s and early 1840s, there were essentially two main Quaker strains of thought about what to do about slavery, abolition, and activist movements like the Underground Railroad. The first was that slavery was evil and that Quakers should do all they can to help end it, including helping slaves to escape. The second was that Quakers should concentrate instead their efforts on legal emancipation. That is, working in the political realm to end slavery first and then work on how to improve the lives of freed peoples. This second group, you see, also thought that working in the Underground Railroad was dangerous, which was true, and it put too many lives at risk, not only the escaping slaves, but those who helped them, and maybe even children, both cases, escaping slaves who were children and the children of Underground Railroad workers. So this second group, wanted any energy used in the Underground Railroad movement to be put behind the call for emancipation and legal abolition of slavery. By the early 1840s, the second school of thought was gaining the upper hand among Quaker leaders. The Society of Friends insisted that its members resign from direct action groups such as the Underground Railroad. The Coffins, along with a number of like-minded Quakers, refused and were thrown out of the Society of Friends. They formed the Anti-Slavery Friends and continued their work in the Underground Railroad. But the whole broad effect that slavery had had on American society and had on the American economy bothered Levi Coffin more intensely as the 1840s progressed. It was one thing to help fugitive slaves, but Coffin also knew that many of the things he sold in his dry goods business and much of the money that flowed through his banking interests had all of its origins in slavery. Slave labor helped create and distribute a great number of commodities, and many people, including Northerners, had profited monetarily from selling goods produced by that slave labor. Increasingly, Coffin became convinced that slavery could only be abolished if, in addition to political action, economic pressure was placed on the whole system. So he once again tried to cleanse his business of the stain of slavery. Levi began to listen to overtures from free produce associations. I'm putting these in quotation marks, capital F, capital P, capital A, free produce associations from the Northeast. These free produce associations, or societies, were essentially merchant and consumer pressure groups who refused to purchase or sell products and commodities that had been created by slave labor. Now, these associations and societies weren't new. They'd been around since the 1770s and 1780s in England, where they'd concentrated on boycotting slave-produced sugar. The idea spread to the United States in the 1820s, and free produce associations were founded in several northeastern states. Now, as I said a little earlier, the Coffins had tried to boycott slave-produced products in their Newport stores, but it had proved too difficult. But the Eastern Free Product Associations now worked to start similar movements in, again, what was then called the West, Ohio and Indiana. And the Coffin saw an opportunity to try this moral experiment again. Now, to make a long story short, Levi and Catherine Coffin were convinced to move to Cincinnati, Ohio in 1847 to run a wholesale mercantile business on the free produce model. They were reluctant to leave Indiana, but were ultimately convinced by Ohio Quakers and leaders of the American free produce movement to go to Cincinnati and to try. Cincinnati, of course, is on the northern bank of the Ohio River and directly across from the slave state of Kentucky. In its own way, the city was sort of a halfway house for the anti-slavery movement in the border states. Crossing the Ohio River became a metaphorical as well as a physical journey to freedom. and Cincinnati was often seen as the gateway. The anti-slavery movement was already well established there and had held its own against fugitive slave catchers from the South and against pro-slavery, or at the very least, anti-abolitionist forces in Ohio. And it was, of course, as you can imagine, a constant struggle. But the fact that the struggle was even going on, combined with the fact that a new Western Free Produce Association there had the backing of Eastern abolitionists and the Eastern Free Produce Movement, made it seem like an excellent place for the Coffins to further their Underground Railroad work. They began that work in Cincinnati much in the same way that they had begun their work in Indiana, by gradually reaching out to local people they trusted and building the underground structure slowly and safely. At the same time, Levi built the free produce business side of the operation. Now, the business side proved to be the more difficult of the two. One of the problems with dealing in only free goods, that is, goods produced only by free labor, was that the number of suppliers was often small. And since commodities such as sugar, rice, and cotton and tobacco were overwhelmingly Southern and slave produced, it was difficult and expensive to find free produce suppliers. There were such suppliers, and even one free cotton plantation down in Mississippi, but there weren't enough to make it so that Levi could rely on a steady supply of quality goods that Northerners and Westerners would buy. The purity of their production, the fact that they were free labor produced rather than slave labor produced, was only one part of their attractiveness to buyers. And often, Levi Coffin wasn't able to get quality goods from enough free production suppliers to make the Cincinnati business viable. So eventually, he had to sell it in 1857. The Underground Railroad side of their lives in Ohio, however, was very successful in the dozen or so years leading up to the Civil War. Just like in Indiana, Levi and Catherine had a large home in Cincinnati and used much of it, ostensibly, as a rooming house or a guest house. And also like their businesses and other safe houses they had run, there was, well, safety in numbers. Lots of people came and went to the Coffin House on a fairly consistent basis, and it was very difficult for slave catchers to determine whether any one of them was an escaped slave. Catherine Coffin started another clothing and sewing circle in Cincinnati and began to produce servants' clothes for escaped slaves. It was fairly easy to explain the presence of so many servants at the house, and Catherine had them dressed as garden workers, cooks, butlers, and stable hands. She also disguised a number of female escapees in traditional female Quaker attire, that is, full-length dresses, blouses with long sleeves, gloves, veils, and a traditional wide-brimmed Quaker hat that helped a great number of women go unnoticed around their house. Sometimes she even had escaped slaves pose as servants and attendants for the other guests at the rooming house, as if they had been traveling with them, if you see what I mean. All this worked very well. Historians of the Underground Railroad have estimated that the Coffins helped nearly 1,300 slaves escape through Cincinnati over roughly a dozen years. This changed dramatically once the Civil War broke out. The Coffins were, of course, pacifists, but they supported the Union cause and served in a Union military hospital during the war. They took recuperating soldiers to their home to free up space in the hospital for other wounded soldiers. They also built an orphanage for African-American children whose parents were serving in the Union forces. Laws and proclamations in the early years of the war, including the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, made it somewhat easier for African-Americans who were able to get away and to get north or to join Union forces to be protected by the American Army, even though technically the Fugitive Slave Act wasn't abolished until 1864. So the Underground Railroad became slightly above ground, if you will, and the Coffins were able to, add to their already extensive rescue efforts in southern Ohio. Now, Levi Coffin became one of the leaders in the Freedmen's Aid Society after the war, helping freed people economically, sometimes providing an education. He was an American delegate to the International Anti-Slavery Conference in Paris in 1867, and he and Catherine were strong proponents of what became the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which prohibited the federal government and the states from denying male citizens the right to vote based on those citizens' quote, race, color, or previous condition of servitude, end quote. The Coffins retired from public life and their various humanitarian efforts in 1870-1871. These two, having done the work of a dozen people at least themselves, were no doubt worn out. They were hailed as leaders of the Underground Railroad, and often they were called the founders, but we'll explain the complications surrounding that in our next episode. Levi Coffin died in the family home in the Avondale neighborhood of Cincinnati in 1877, and his funeral was one of the largest the city had ever seen. Catherine died in 1881. An African-American group in Ohio built a monument to Levi Coffin at his gravesite in 1902. Perhaps the most enduring homage to the Coffins is that they were probably the models for the characters of Simeon and Rachel Halliday in Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin, published in 1852. The Hallidays rescued their protagonist, Eliza Harris, a young slave who had crossed the Ohio River during the winter. She was nearly dying from exhaustion and exposure when they found her. They nursed her back to health, they sheltered her, they clothed her, until it was safe for Eliza to continue towards Canada. So keep that in mind the next time you're reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, which I recommend very highly. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that according to experts in this field, Levi and Catherine Coffin were responsible for helping somewhere between 3,000 and 3,300 slaves escape along the Underground Railroad. 2,000 in Indiana and 1,000 to 1,300 in Ohio. And again, although I don't like scoreboard history when it comes to, you know, assessing the importance of the work that humanitarians did in the past, this is an enormous number. I don't think we should rank heroes by stats, so to speak, in history, but the Coffins deserve a great deal more attention than they've been given. Let's not forget, there were hundreds of Underground Railroad workers. It's virtually impossible to know how many there were, and even to a large extent, who they were, mainly because, you know, helping slaves escape was dangerous and had to be kept secret. And helping any slave was potentially life-threatening. Even helping one slave was a true act of heroism. But I want to argue that it's only virtually impossible to find out who they were. Despite being the dusty and hidden past, there are still many, many, many things to be discovered about the Underground Railroad and the people whose lives deserve more attention. Here's where scoreboard history or history by numbers can really work. According to the stats we keep here at the Buzzkill Institute, there are 1,775 buzzkillers in North Carolina, where the Coffins started their work, 1,515 Indiana buzzkillers, and 3,045 Ohio buzzkillers. That's a lot of potential researchers. Imagine what we could do with that kind of workforce. If you have some free time, please go to your local library, county archives or record office, your local college or university archives, and of course, your local historical society. Volunteer to help work through the evidence we have about ordinary people from the past. You'll be surprised how much evidence is available and how much has yet to be uncovered. Talk to you next week.